The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Julie Zickafoos. Hello, Julie.
Hey, Vic. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Julie joins us on the telephone from somewhere out in beautiful southeastern Ohio. Isn't that where you are?
I am. I'm in the southeast corner of Ohio, 18 miles northeast of Marietta.
Okay. Is that where they're building the castle just down the road?
How did you know?
I do my research.
Lord.
Lords and ladies, from what I hear.
Yes. I've been stopped many times on my running route to be asked where the castle is, and I always tell them that they can't see it from the road.
Okay. Well, we digress very quickly. Julie's most recent book is Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. And this is one of the most beautiful books, and it's also incredibly informative. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to write a book like this.
Well, actually, I give a whole talk on that. I got asked it so many times that I thought, you know, this is what people actually want to know, is how a book like this happens. And I really trace it back to my early influences, books that my father gave to me, read to me, chief among them, Wild Animals I Have Known by Ernest Thompson Seton, Canadian naturalist, mid-1800s. Just fabulous, fabulous stuff. And the things that moved me as a child were the books that were illustrated by the authors.
Mm-hmm.
Holling, Clancy Holling and his wife illustrated these amazing books like Pagoo, The Story of a Hermit Crab, Men of the Mississippi, which was about a snapping turtle. And I sensed a veracity in these books because they were illustrated by the authors that I did not find anywhere else. And so I grew up with that as my model. Conrad Lorenz, another one, his animal behavior books, all illustrated with his own sketches and drawings. So that was my model. And I guess I knew I wanted to write books a long, long, long time ago, but it didn't really hit me until about 1991 when I was illustrating a book about backyard birds, and I got a hold of the manuscript, and I asked the designer if I might do a little rewrite, and I wound up pretty much rewriting the book. But I was just the illustrator. And the book went on to win a John Burroughs Nature Medal, and I had a sneaking suspicion that, if not my rewrite, at least my big color paintings had something to do with that. So I thought, why am I not writing my own books? So naturally, you write what you know. And what I know a lot about is birds' nests and baby birds, because I've been working as a licensed wildlife rehabilitator since I was probably in my early 20s, and I won't say how long that's been. But I guess I got my license in about 1981, and I've had it continuously in a number of states ever since, state and federal permits to handle and raise baby birds. So this is a natural outgrowth of the kind of thing that I love to do, and the kind of insights that I get by being the mother to a bird that you can't get any other way. And since I've always done illustration and drawing and painting, it was the most natural thing in the world to look at a nest of hatching baby bluebirds and want to take it into the studio and paint that moment. And then I thought, well, what would happen if I took a baby out every day and painted its picture and then put it back? Came out the same time the next day, painted it again, and put it back. And by the time I'd done 2 or 3 days of painting of the bluebirds, I was completely hooked, and I was thinking about what other species I could work with.
Some of our listeners are recoiling in horror at the sound of your description of taking these birds out of the nests. We've all been told you just don't touch baby birds.
Of course, but you'll notice that I told you I was licensed by the state and federal permits. But also, here's the thing. You do have to know exactly what you're doing, and you have to work with nests that cannot be raided by predators. So the nests that I worked with in the beginning were all ones, birds that were nesting in birdhouses that I had put up on metal poles that were protected by baffles so that predators couldn't climb up and raid the nest. And then later on, I expanded my my species selection to include some open cup nesters, such as birds like, chipping sparrows that nest in a bush just with an open cup nest, that kind of thing. But I had to do it in very, very special situations because primum non nocere, first cause no harm, was my motto from the beginning. So it's not true, actually, that adult birds will abandon their nests if you touch their babies. They can't smell you on their young. They will not desert their nest just because someone has looked at it or touched a baby. They're very, very bonded to their young. But having said that, you really have to know what you're doing. Mm. And you have to make absolutely sure you're not going to cause harm.
Julie Zickefoos joins us. Her book is Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. And you have it divided up into chapters, each devoted to a particular bird that you ended up painting day by day as these little creatures were developing. And it's really amazing to read in each section how different the process was for all these birds. There was, of course, a lot of similarities, but I learned so much, and I loved so many of these chapters. But I think if I had to pick a favorite one, it would be the one about these wonderful birds that somehow, amazingly, you were able to observe the chimney swifts. That chapter just blew my mind.
Chimney swifts actually blew my mind because when I got seven of them to care for, I realized that I was no longer on the bunny slope of bird rehabilitation. And I actually I lost a few of them before I figured out how to take care of them properly. There's an art to raising chimney swifts because they have such a strange natural history and they have strange requirements and they have a very strange lifestyle. So, yeah, I'm thrilled that you liked that chapter. That was a cool one.
I think at the end, when you release them, that is so powerful, the way you described that and where it was and how it happened.
Yeah, it's never easy to release these birds, but it was really difficult to release birds who, by their natural history, take off and never come back. Now, most of the birds that I wind up raising and releasing hang around my yard for a month and a half after I release them. Mm. I can make sure they're doing fine. I can call them in. I can give them mealworms or whatever they need to eat, and then they'll go back off into the woods, and I'll go, well, see you in a couple hours. So it's a gradual stretching of the bonds. But with the chimney swifts, I just had to basically throw them into the air and say good luck.
I loved how you changed your thinking about the project because you did this for a number of years. It took a long time to do all this, and your daughter really made a difference because she suggested to you, well, why aren't you doing pictures of some of these birds that you're spurning? Why are you ignoring the sparrows and the starlings? And
the child is the father of the man, and the child shall lead us. That is absolutely the truth, and I'm thrilled to have my 20-year-old redhead sitting at the kitchen table doing a project as I speak. She's home briefly. She's an oceanography major at Bowdoin College in Maine, and she has always been wiser than me. And one of the things she said to me was, why are you kicking house sparrows out of your bluebird box? Why don't you paint the baby house sparrows? And I stopped like somebody had clobbered me on the head with a cast iron frying pan because it had never occurred to me to do that. So, and it turned out that house sparrows is one of my favorite chapters because they were such fascinating little birds. They were just so palpably intelligent and so resourceful. Really, really neat birds.
They are beautiful birds. And I love starlings. I love hearing them sing.
Oh, me too. Me too. And I confess that, and I will say my favorite paintings in the book are the starling nestlings. Once again, I have Phoebe to thank for that. Starling nestlings look like nothing you've ever seen in your life. They look like inflated Martian gut bags with giant yellow clown lips. And as an artist, you know, we're all drawn to the bizarre, so that was just like a picnic for me painting those things.
Explain to our listeners how you did the setup when you'd have these little wriggling creatures there and how you were able to draw them so quickly and what you were feeding them and just the process of how you had the paper down. You explain it all in the book.
Yeah. Well, I like to say that, you know, painting baby birds from life is a skill set that very few people possess, because not only do you have to know how to sketch something rapidly from life, you have to be comfortable with drawing from life, something that wriggles, but you also have to know what to feed the thing and how to keep it warm and how to approach the nest so that you don't endanger it. So there's all this stuff going on. And I remember somebody saying to me once, aren't you worried somebody's going to scoop your idea? And I said, never occurred to me. I said, who knows how to do all this stuff? So, what I do basically is I go out and to one of my nest boxes. I'd go get the baby. Because the baby birds tend to keep the same position in the nest every day, so basically if you have a bird in the lower right corner of the nest on Tuesday, that's going to be that same individual in that corner on Wednesday. So I'd go out, I'd get my baby, I'd bring it back into the studio. If it was a cold day, I'd either hold it in my hand or I'd have a lamp close to keep it warm. I'd put it on a tissue or hold it in my palm. I would sketch it, hold it in my left hand and sketch it with my right, right onto the paper. I was, you know, the final paper. And I would paint it rapidly while it was there in front of me so I'd get all those colors exactly right. And one of the things you can see in the book is that amazing gradation of color that they change color every day. Like baby bluebirds start out this amazing yellow coral orange, and then they go to a much cooler pinky red as they age, and then they turn sort of a dark blue as the blood feathers come up through their skin. So all that stuff was important to me to note. And then when I'm done, I tried to keep it under an hour, usually came in at around 40 minutes. I would hurry back and put the baby back in its nest in the same position where I'd found it. The other thing I would do is I'd often feed it three or four times during that 40 minutes. So what I noticed right away was that my babies gained weight and grew better than their nest mates, the ones that I was focusing on because I was feeding them.
And you're quite a wonderful cook for these creatures. you make these like insect omelets for them, and I've heard of Zik dough. That's another popular one. My guest is Julie Zikafoos. You can meet her this afternoon. She'll be in Dayton for an event at Allwood, and she'll be talking about her book, Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest, and then autographing copies. And that's at the Marie S. All Education Center, 1000 Allwood Road in Dayton. And there's a nominal charge, unless you're a member of Friends of Allwood or the National Audubon Society, and those members are given free admission. And this is going to be really exciting to have you in Dayton to talk about baby birds. We have so many people out there who love birds, who love watching birds. And I understand that you and your husband are kind of hardcore. Don't you have like a giant bird watching tower above your house?
Yeah, we have like a 41-foot bird-watching tower on the top of our house, which is painted red, so it kind of reads like a barn with a silo. And, we watch birds from there. And my husband is actually editor of Birdwatchers Digest, which is published in Marietta, Ohio, by his family. It's one of the only remaining family-owned and operated magazines in the country, if not the world.
Wow.
The two species that intrigued me greatly were house finch and mourning dove. And the reason they intrigued me was they are both obligate vegetarians. And because I'm interested in nutrition, I'm not a pro by any means, but I pay attention to nutrition, it seemed to me that it would be hard to develop very quickly on a strict vegetarian diet.
Uh-huh.
Most of the birds, like cardinals and indigo buntings that eat nothing but insects when they're young, develop very quickly, such that they're leaving the nest by the time they're only 9 days old. They're fledging.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they aren't really ready for prime time. They have short little wings and practically no tail, and, you know, parts of their bodies still don't have feathers, but they are out of the nest. So the question I asked was, let's look at a couple of obligate vegetarians, the house finch and the mourning dove, and see how fast they develop. House finches eat nothing but seeds, feed their babies nothing but seeds, and those babies stay in the nest for as long as 18 to 20 days,
mm-hmm.
which is an eternity for an open-cup nester like the house finch. Most open-cup nesters are out of the nest in a little over 8, 9, 10 days, right in around there. So here are these things sitting in the nest for like 20 days. Amazing. But that kind of followed what I thought might happen with a vegetarian. Mourning doves, on the other hand, leave the nest and are fully feathered and flying by day 10.
Mm.
And the way they do this is they feed their babies this rocket sauce that they produce in their crops, in their esophageal tract, and they slough the epithelial cells off the lining of the crop, and they regurgitate that and feed it to the babies, and by dry weight, it's 57% protein.
Whoa.
Yeah, whoa is right. So these things, they basically look like you're taking a bicycle pump and inflating them every day, baby mourning dove. And they don't explode. They actually turn it into feathers, and they're flying by day 10. It's incredible.
Well, this time of year in southern Ohio, if we have a blanket of snow, we see the northern cardinals, and they stand out. They're so beautiful. And I always just thought, well, gosh, you know, they're so prolific. There's so many of them. And then reading your book, I discovered that they really have to work very hard to survive, don't they?
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things that kind of vexes me about certain birds, like cardinals and indigo buntings. And these birds nest in these low shrubs. They build flimsy nests that are just, cardinal nest is just sort of like a platform of twigs. And they lay 2 to 3 eggs. Cardinals don't put a lot of eggs in the clutch because they're so vulnerable to predation in these places where they nest. So it turns out that something like well over 50% of cardinal nests are predated, eaten by snakes and mice and chipmunks and anything else, blue jays, all that, before they ever make it. And so cardinals have to try again and again. So they have a very long breeding season. They'll start nesting in April, and they will nest right through September sometimes, just trying to get a few babies out into that world.
In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And I've been joined on the telephone today by Julie Zicafus. Her book, Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. And you can meet her this afternoon. She will be at Allwood giving a talk about this beautiful book. And that starts at 2:30 this afternoon, Allwood, 1000 Allwood Road in Dayton. And she'll be signing copies of this gorgeous book after her talk. And she has chapters in here for the tree swallow, the ruby-throated hummingbird, the Carolina chickadee, the tufted titmouse, house finch, yellow-billed cuckoo, which was one of the most bizarre chapters, and I'm not going to give that away. You can save that for your talk. I didn't know any of this stuff about the cuckoo. In fact, I've never seen a cuckoo, as far as I know. And I'm wondering, why are some birds that I would think would be really obvious not in here? Like, say, a robin. Why isn't the robin in there?
Didn't get one. It wasn't for lack of trying.
Really?
But yeah. In fact, right as the book was going to press, I had a robin finally nest in my yard low enough so that I could hope to see into the nest. Well, I'll qualify that. Robins are open-cup nesters, so they nest in an unprotected nest in a tree, not in a cavity, not in a birdhouse. So right there, they're going to be usually inaccessible to me. But I ran out and bought a selfie stick that would extend to like 15 feet. And I put my iPhone on it, and I tested it tirelessly on other things. And then I finally had my technique. And my plan was, with this robin, to every day go underneath the nest, which was about 12 feet up in a tree, point my camera down at it on the selfie stick, take a couple shots, walk away. So I would never touch the nest. I'd never approach it directly. And it was all working great. And on day 4, something got the eggs. And it was, or got the young babies. It was probably a black rat snake, because that's the most typical predator around here.
Mm-hmm.
When you find the nest simply empty, that's usually who's done it. If a raccoon had done it, it would have torn the nest down for good measure. So, you know, that's why robin isn't in there, because they're supremely vulnerable to predation, and I couldn't put the birds in jeopardy, you know, for my little study. So I had to find ways that would not endanger them, but still, you know, it still got predated.
Well, that wasn't a complaint. I was just curious.
Well, I know you would think with robins nesting on people's porch lights and everything, you know, that I'd be able to do that. But you have to remember that I have to be near the bird. I can't, like, drive 50 miles, go get a robin, and then put it back in the nest.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Even though you were able to do a series of studies for some birds in Tennessee.
True. That was one that was just too good not to do. Prothonotary warbler was the crown jewel, really, of the birds that I could do, because it is a cavity nester. There was the potential that I could access a nest without endangering it by having the nest on a protected baffled pole so predators couldn't climb up. And my poor friend Cindy in Tennessee sent me an email. She goes, guess what I've got nesting in a box in my backyard? And I go, what? And she sent me a photo of a prothonotary warbler, and I said, Cindy, got a proposal for you. How would you like to, number one, make sure this nest is completely protected from predators, number two, take a picture of the babies every day? She was on it like the white on rice, and we worked together very closely, and that's actually the whole chapter is an epistolary chapter of our emails that, you know, flew back and forth between us as we did the project together.
Mm. The book is Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. The artist is Julie Zickafoos, and she joins us on the program today. I live in a heavily wooded area, and with all the dead ash trees out there, it is a paradise for woodpeckers. And now and then, I'll get lucky, and I'll spot a pileated woodpecker. And I think that they are my favorite ones. I love hearing them call. I love seeing how beautiful they are with the cockades and hearing that call that they make to each other. Oh, there's some good bugs over here, I assume is what they're saying. And then to see those gigantic holes that they make. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite bird of the birds in this area? Do you have one?
Oh, boy, I'm a huge fan of pileated woodpeckers as well.
Mm.
And, you know, part of it is just, they just seem too big and exotic to even exist. And you see this thing with all the white in the wings. And lately I've been working on my imitation of their voice. I do a lot of sort of bird calls so that I can talk to them.
Oh.
And I've been working on that high cackle that they do, that sort of
uh-huh.
kind of thing. And I still haven't got it to my satisfaction, but I want to be able to talk to pileated woodpeckers.
That was good. We have one bumping into the window right now. It must have heard you.
You don't want a pileated woodpecker banging on your window, that's for sure. You know, I have to say that some of my favorite birds include Carolina wrens,
uh-huh.
just because I live among them and I have a keen appreciation for how intelligent and inventive they are. I also raised one this past summer, after the book had come out. And that bird affected me and my family so profoundly that I'm going to have to put him in a future book.
Oh.
It wasn't a happy story. The bird failed to fledge with the rest of them,
mm-hmm.
and they were fledging out of a copper bucket on my front porch where they've nested for well over two decades. And this little thing just wasn't right. I could see that. And I thought, well, I'm going to give you a chance because you can't fly yet, but maybe if I bring you along, I can release you back with your family.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he never turned out not to be releasable. I'm pretty sure he probably had a neurological disorder or perhaps a brain tumor. And he was only with us for 24 days, but in that amount of time, I learned so much about birds' capacity for love, attachment, incredible bonding, incredible sense of humor. That bird just had it all and was packed into a bird that was no bigger than my thumb. So maybe Cheapy will have a chapter or maybe even a book of his own. He was an incredible little bird.
I agree with you about the bird's capacity to express affection to humans. It's probably shocking to some listeners to think that, but it's really true, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. And I think it's all the more precious when it comes from a wild bird. You know, we're all used to parrots snuggling up to our cheeks or budgies sitting on our thumb and talking to us, but when it's given by a wild bird, there's just something so disarming about that. The hummingbird chapter touches on that.
Uh-huh.
I raised four hummingbirds having no idea what cool birds they were and how amazingly inventive, intelligent, adaptable, funny that they were. And I guess I just thought hummingbirds must be different from other birds because they were so tiny. I guess I thought they were kind of more like cicadas. But they turned out to be all bird and then some. Same is true of chimney swifts. I never thought that chimney swifts would have much personality because the only way I knew them was as these feathered cigars just rocketing over twittering. I didn't know anything about what made them tick until I raised them. And then I found out that they are just hilarious and fabulous birds. They're just so cool.
Mm. My guest is Julie Zickafoos. Her book is Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. And she'll be coming to Dayton this afternoon. You can meet her. She'll be at Allwood at 2:30 giving a talk about baby birds. And she'll also be doing a book signing. That's at 2:30, 1000 Allwood Road in Dayton. You can meet her. And she's coming in all the way from southeastern Ohio, where I imagine it's a really great place to watch birds.
It's fabulous. We're in the rumpled Appalachian foothills, and we have an 80-acre sanctuary here. We've had 194 species of birds on the place. That includes flyovers, some of them quite unexpected, short-eared owl, semi-palmated plover, sedge wren, Kirtland's warbler, Dick Sissel, white-winged crossbill. The list of rarities goes on. But it's the common stuff that's around all the time that really compels me and really draws me and is the fountain, you know, that I work from.
What was the most out-of-territory bird you've seen on your place?
We have had snow geese fly
snow
over.
Snow geese, mm.
We have had black-crowned night heron. We've had, as I said, sedge wren. Kirtland's warbler was probably the rarest bird we've had, mm-hmm. but not entirely unexpected because we are on the migration route, more or less. But that's a federally endangered bird that, you know, there's a handful of thousand of birds in the world, so to have that on our place is a pretty big deal. Out of range, I'm trying to think here. Sedge wren is pretty well out of range. But it's great fun, you know, to amass these lists of birds and just say, oh, we haven't had that. That's a new bird for the sanctuary, that kind of thing.
Well,
really fun.
Well, I'm a bird lover, and it's really been a pleasure talking to you, Julie.
Oh, you too, Vic. Wonderful. I got to say, your voice is really soothing. You make me relax.
Oh, good. The book is Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. And as you read it and you think about those sparrows and those starlings that are such a nuisance out there taking food from the pretty birds at your feeders. Well, when you read Julie's book, you'll see that when you go back to where they came from, places like England, they're actually becoming somewhat endangered. And maybe you should appreciate them a little bit more.
Absolutely. In fact, Vic, I'm doing a painting coming up of red-crowned Amazon parrots, which have been all but extirpated from their native range in Mexico. And now exist in the greatest concentration in and around Harlingen and Brownsville, Texas.
Wow.
There are probably 6,000 individuals in the entire world, and most of them are in South Texas now. And this is a bird that, yes, it's an exotic, but it was a natural range expansion because when the dry thorn habitat was eliminated in northern Mexico, where are those birds going to go?
Mm-hmm.
So they came into the suburbs of South Texas, and there they thrive, and it's a beautiful story. So, yeah, we need to be open to bird range expansions. They're always fluid, and we need to appreciate birds where they are.
Thank you so much for your time, Julie.
Thanks, Vic, very much.
You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and don't forget, you can meet Julie this afternoon at 2:30 at Allwood. Thanks for listening.